Welcome to the Rent to Rent Success Podcast, the only podcast entirely dedicated to helping you achieve rent to rent success. We talk about the ethical way to get you started in property without buying it. This is our place to inspire each other to believe bigger, to be bolder, and to be game changers for good. Property investors and sisters Stephanie and Nikki Taylor are your guides on this exciting ride. Let's start up the engines and get ready to fly. Hello, 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 and welcome to this episode of the Rent to Rent Success Podcast. I'm so excited that you're joining me here today. We are here with Ben Beadle, and he is the Chief Executive of the National Residential Landlords Association. And with so much change going on in this world, we really do need this guidance. And it's a phenomenal organization. So I'm joined today by Ben Beadle. And Ben, as well as being CEO of the NRLA, has also been a landlord for over 20 years. And that's what I think gives the organization its very practical focus on how we can do what we do better. So Ben also, before that, has had a lengthy career in housing, in places for people and at the TDS. And so he's a really familiar face in the sector and in the media. The new NRLA was brought together from the Residential Landlords Association and the National Landlords Association 3 years ago, and really provides that first class support to landlords. So welcome to the show, Ben Beadle.
Stephanie, thank you very much. Really pleased to be with you today.
Brilliant. Now, we have really found the NRLA outstanding, because when we first started as more, you know, as a business of being in landlords 6 years ago, we really relied on that guidance. And with all the changes that are coming up, we still do rely on that guidance. And we go to the website because it is in plain English. And sometimes the guidance that comes out from government is quite difficult to decipher. So
indeed. No, I think you're right. A lot of landlords join us for that reason, Stephanie, because, you know, we represent the responsible majority who want to get things right. And it's incumbent on us to make sure that we provide all of the services to give landlords all of the tools in their armory or inbox or whatever you want to call it, to be able to provide a first-class job to their tenants. And so that's why we invest so much in not just the documents and forms, actually, and supporting information, but the support line, phone a friend for landlords, 3,000 calls last week. And yeah, it's absolutely bonkers. Because as you say, there's so much change going on in our sector that the only thing that you can be certain about nowadays is uncertainty. Whether you are a landlord in England or Wales, there's lots that the association is doing, not just on the sort of lobbying and campaigning front, but on research and providing day-to-day help for landlords to get better at what they do.
Yeah, absolutely. And so let's get straight into it then, Ben. There have been a lot of changes. And what would you say, what's your view on the current landscape for HMO landlords?
Yeah, well, it's tricky. It is tricky. There's no question about this. And it's, you know, it will be tricky not just for HMO landlords, but for all types of landlords, but particularly tricky for HMO landlords. I guess, if you're a HMO landlord in England, you're going to be looking at the Renters Reform Bill that has now been announced and released, and probably being quite worried in a couple of very specific areas. So firstly, around what the whole periodic tenancy means and the abolition of the fixed term. And secondly, although relevant to all landlords, particularly relevant to HMO landlords, is how you would manage antisocial behaviour with Section 21 going. I know that that's been a matter of grave concern. And so you'll be looking at those two things and being a little bit worried, I think. And if you happen to be a HMO landlord in the student sector, then you have another worry about whether or not your tenancy cycle will work in the new world, i.e. running from sort of, you know, summer to summer. Because of course, whilst landlords can now only or will only be able to give notice for a reason, for a legitimate reason, even though I think they did anyway, but anyway, enough of that, a legitimate reason in the new world, tenants can of course, or will of course, be able to give notice from day one as it stands currently, 2 months notice. And so that has the risk of putting the whole business model of the student sector at peril.
Yes, very good point. I think they'll fix that though, won't they? The government already.
They better do.
Yeah, the government already.
Well, we're lobbying very hard on this point, because we see it as very much being something that doesn't need to be fixed right now. You know, the student market, firstly, is a very niche market. And of course, if you happen to be a student in purpose-built student accommodation, you will be used to, in your first year, a license that runs for a fixed period where you're fixed and you go from summer to summer. Yeah. And all we're asking for is that when that student comes out of halls into the PRS student market, is that they're afforded the same courtesy of being able to predict when the property is going to be available. And that works both ways for landlords and renters. So we're lobbying very hard on a couple of areas. Firstly, that we want a ground to be able to get possession for student renters in HMOs. And secondly, and this is across the PRS, is that whilst we are not campaigning to reinstate the fixed term, because we won't get it, it's as simple as that, we are saying that in the same way that landlords can't give a notice inside the first 6 months if they wish to sell or move back in, i.e. a no-fault reason, well, we say that that should be extended to tenants, so that in the first defined period, call it 6 months, 4 months, whatever, you can't give a notice unless the property is uninhabitable. And what we think that will do is a couple of things. Is firstly, it will deal for the most part with the student cycle and kind of preserve it to summer to summer, roughly, not perfectly, but roughly. And secondly, it will stop the PRS turning into Airbnb, where people move in day one, give a notice and bugger off 2 months later. That's not what we want, because of course, and government accept this, it's expensive to set up a tenancy. And so if you want to have fairness, which is what Mr. Gove has told me that he wants, I don't think it is fair that landlords expend a huge amount of money setting up a tenancy only to do it again in 2.5 months' time when somebody gives notice. And so those are the changes that we are lobbying for, that we want to see, that we say strike the balance between giving tenants greater security and greater rights, but also bringing responsible landlords along with you, giving them confidence that the new rules will work, and making it fair also for HMO landlords and particularly student landlords where PBSA works in a particular way already.
Yes. Fabulous. Just for listeners who may be new to the lingo, the PRS is the private rented sector. And thank you, Ben, for drawing out the two important points that you're lobbying on at the moment. The periodic tenancy, that's the end of the 6 month or 12 month fixed term AST, a move to a periodic tenancy. The implications for student tenancies, we'll class that as one. And the secondly, evicting tenants who are antisocial. And I actually did an episode, if you want to get more on what the impact of the Renters Reform Bill is for HMO landlords and specifically rent-to-rent managers or rent-to-rent businesses, I did an episode, that's episode 181, which goes into this a bit further. But I think these are two areas really interesting for us to focus on. And what I want to ask you, Ben, is with the periodic tenancies that are coming in, my argument was it's not especially different. We'll have to see if tenants use it differently, because if a tenant moves in and then, you know, after 2 months or 3 months, they say, I'm moving now to the other side of the country for a job. And, you know, we come to an arrangement with them about the exact date they'll move, or we find someone else to move in and we let them go. We're not trying to charge them for the rest of the term of their tenancy, as we could have done in theory, we could do legally. Not sure that would really work in practice. So we're not really doing that. But it will be interesting to see if people do use it differently and if more of the short term. But the question I wanted to ask, which I haven't asked yet, is what I understood is that the notice period that tenants can give is to the end of the rental period. So that means if they move in on day one, the earliest they could move out, according to this interpretation, is the end of month three rather than the end of month two, if they gave their notice on day one. Have you heard discussions about this? And do you know whether it's actually the end of month two they could move out or the end of month three?
So a couple of things. One, I would agree with you that I don't expect this to change tenants' habits on day one, to be honest with you, Stephanie. So we know the average tenancy length is 4 and a bit years in the private rented sector. Sorry for my acronyms earlier. And I, you know, with the shortage of homes, I don't think tenants are going to change their habits dramatically, but they might, and that's what we're safeguarding against. To answer your point specifically, I'd understood that a tenant could give notice on day one for it to expire 2 months later. However, what my overriding concerns with the bill is that we're still lacking quite a lot of detail. Some of the mechanics, you know, take the ombudsman that's been referenced, the rent tribunal. There's kind of still a lot of detail to be teased out about how some of these things work. Sorry, the property portal, I meant, not the tribunal. So yeah, we don't know how much it's going to cost. We don't know what data needs to be put in, you know, all of those things. So all we have got within the bill is an enabling bill that gives the power to be able to do certain things. At the moment, we have none of the details. So there's so many conversations going on with government, with Gove's team and others. In fact, I have a call this very afternoon with Mr. Gove's team to talk through some of this detail. So I think in terms of that specific point, I can't give you a concrete yay or nay, but I know that it's Mr. Gove's intention to be able to give notice on day one. And I would kind of expect, if it's 2 months notice, to expire 2 weeks later. But I get there's a technical point there about when notices expire and all of that sort of jazz. But I don't know is the honest answer.
Yeah, I think I would be much happier with the 3 month minimum than a 2 month minimum. So I was hopeful when I saw that in the draft text that it's to do with the end of the rental period. But anyway, I'm sure that it will come to light. So let's talk next about asking people to leave, basically. Section 21 is ending, and it looks as though we may, according to what is drafted, have some stronger and faster ways of removing people who are antisocial or don't pay their rent.
Yeah, I mean, certainly if you listen to what Mr. Gove says and what the Prime Minister has said on this matter, they have been very, very strong on antisocial behaviour and on rent arrears. And they've done that for two reasons. Firstly, MPs get a lot of correspondence about antisocial behaviour. And nobody wants to know that it's going to take, in a rented property, upwards of 6-9 months to get somebody out. And politicians don't want to be in the position of being found out that they've supported a bill that's enabled that to happen, right? Also, your average person in the street finds antisocial behaviour unacceptable.
Yeah.
Whether it's drugs, whether it's become a knocking shop, or whether it's just, noise or low-level nuisance, that is unacceptable. Mm. And if your kids are being woken up at 3 o'clock in the morning by this stuff, actually what you want to know is that the court and the law is on your side, mm-hmm. not the perpetrator's side. And that's the argument, Stephanie, that we have successfully carved out. Now, with all of this, the devil is in the detail, right? And so I'm very pleased to see two grounds for antisocial behaviour. One, mandatory, but that's subject to, which means when we say mandatory ground, that means the judge has no discretion. He or she must award possession, providing they're satisfied that you met the test. And that test is a criminal conviction. So you either got one or you haven't, right? Mm. I suspect that ground will be largely academic because it will either be too high to reach because you haven't got a criminal conviction, or if you've been banged up, actually, you've left the property anyway and, the tenancy is the last thing on your mind. The second ground is more contentious, ground 14 of section 8. And what that is a discretionary ground. Now, where we have been successful, this is very technical, is that we have essentially brought the test down. Because there will be some people, and myself included, who will say, well, when I get antisocial behaviour in a HMO, everybody leaves and I'm left with the perpetrator. Yeah. How do I prove my case? Well, with great difficulty, truth be told. And what this ground does is it seeks to address that by saying that the behaviour demonstrated has the ability or the capacity to cause antisocial behaviour, not that it has or does. Mm. And that's important to keep because it is a lower evidential bar that landlords need to meet. And the other thing where we have been successful is that we have short notice periods ranging from zero, from no notice at all to, I think, 4 weeks, which is helpful.
Yes.
And I think that's important because, I sit as a magistrate, actually, Stephanie, so I see some of the antisocial behaviour in social housing where you're dealing with things like closure orders and stuff like that, where that is subject to no notice. And actually the behaviour is so debaucherous and so awful that it needs, it needs to go to the top of the tree in terms of court prioritisation. And so we see that in the magistrates' court. And the thing is, Section 21 was very effective for landlords to be able to deal with because it hasn't changed yet, I'm at pains to say, is very effective at landlords being able to deal with antisocial behaviour because, of course, there is nothing to prove on a Section 21. It's a largely administrative process, and as long as you've served various certificates and got a licence and that sort of stuff, you will get possession. And so in the new world, we want it to be easier for legitimate antisocial behaviour to be proved. So not a backdoor to Section 21, but, not too hard that you can never get possession. And we also want it to be sped up. So short notice periods are a big tick, but we want the court service to prioritise things as quickly as they possibly can. And this is where, for me, the problem lies, because we all know that the court service is on its knees. We saw last week high risk evictions paused because the court service hasn't got the right stab proof vests for their bailiffs and there's a 60-day lead time. Now that to me doesn't sound like an institution that's firing on all cylinders as far as procurement is concerned. And so I will be holding Mr. Gove's feet to the fire on this point because he's been very clear and he writes in our magazine, which goes out in a couple of days, where he's going to be reassuring landlords on this point. And I'm one of the landlords that needs to be reassured. So I'm pleased to see strong commitment on antisocial behaviour. I'm pleased to see short notice periods. I want to see investment in the court system because I don't want things to be prioritised, right? Because if you prioritise ASB, actually you deprioritise something else.
Yeah.
And my point is that where we're moving to, a legitimate reason for eviction, well, it's a legitimate reason. It's not just because the landlord don't like you, which they won't be able to do anymore.
Yeah.
Not that I'm saying they do, but obviously some people have misused it, right? But in a legitimate fault world or a legitimate reason world, but you're entitled to your property back. Why should you wait a year for it? It's unacceptable. Absolutely unacceptable.
Absolutely. I bet you've got some great stories there, Ben. The use of the word debaucherous. Anyway, we won't go down that road to what you hear sitting in court. But what I did like about what you said is I was very excited to see, and do go back to episode 181 if you want more details on this, exactly what you said, Ben, that there will be instances where you can immediately, don't know how that will work in practice, evict somebody. But there are also grounds under 2 weeks, 4 weeks, and of course what we have currently, 2 months. So in actual fact, we should, if this all works as stated with this expedited court system, it should be better for...
Well, it should... Because that's the quid pro quo that Mr. Gove has set out, which is Section 21 is going. He wants to give landlords, responsible landlords, stronger grounds for possession. Actually, he's done that in terms of what's been set out. I'm quite pleased with that we've got a mandatory ground in retained in the first place, because some places like Scotland don't have that. It's entirely down to the judge's discretion. Mm-hmm. So we do have strong grounds for rent arrears and mandatory grounds for rent arrears, not just significant, but also persistent. That's good. We do have workable notice periods and shorter notice periods for ASB. But I come back to my wider point, which is Section 21 didn't need a hearing for the most part. In the court system. But every case, as I understand it, will likely need a hearing, because you will need a judge to look at the evidence and determine. That's one of the downsides of Section 8. And so my concern is that whilst the spin around this is sounds good, the proof will be in the eating, because if you do need a hearing for every case, I'm back to my point about the court system. We don't have enough judges. We don't have enough bailiffs. We don't really have a digitalized system. All of those types of things. And so this is why central to our campaign is that we don't want them to press the button on Section 21 abolition until the judiciary are ready. And I know the judiciary are not ready, because I've spoken with them.
No, they're not firing on any cylinders whatsoever. They're more or less crawling across the ground.
indeed. But it's been that way for some time, so it shouldn't come as a surprise, right? And if you're asking a system that's already slow and and change doesn't happen as quickly as some other institutions, if I cushion it in those terms, if you're asking them to do more, they will need more money, they will need more investment, they will need more resources. That's just common sense, isn't it? So you can't just load up an already broken system with more and expect it to be better without significant investment. And that's the point that we're making.
Absolutely. And such a good point. Before we move on, something you raised there was actually very interesting, which is, previously, for rent arrears, the person had to be in arrears at the time of going to court. And sometimes savvy tenants would pay off their arrears just, on the day of going to court. And then the cycle would continue. But with the new persistent rent arrears, that won't be the case. Can you tell us a bit more about that, Ben?
Yes, I can. So, if I recall correctly, there are three grounds for rent arrears. One is the kind of significant element, and that hasn't changed greatly. Let me just
2 months. Is that right?
Let me just preface my comment. Okay, to say that this is a bill at the moment, right? So there's a whole heap of things that could change before it becomes an act. And obviously there's some of these, a lot of these things we want to keep, and some of the things we want to change to make them better for our audience. So whilst I'm quoting that, that rent arrears is 4 weeks notice if you have at least 2 months, that could change. And there will be people and organizations, not to be named, but who will want to see a longer period, particularly in the context of cost of living, right? But the point that you raise around persistent arrears is also catered for, and that is a 4 week period as well, albeit it is a discretionary ground. And so the point that you're raising about those people that, you know, kind of top up a payment to avoid the 2 months, that is catered for, because if you are persistently in arrears, I think it's 3 times over a 2 year period, then that is a ground for repossession. And that's a direct result of NRLA campaigning on that very point, which is to say, don't game the system. And if you game the system too much, because Gove does recognise there is a cost to getting to court, right? And it will be more costly under Section 8. And if you get all the way to, if you get so far down the track that you've spent a lot of money to get there, you don't want to have your kind of hearing kiboshed just because somebody's paid, you know, £2 to bring them below the threshold. So that is catered for in the bill, as is any rent arrears. So if you have any persistent or significant, they're all 4 weeks. The significant is mandatory. The other two are discretionary, and it's down to the judge's discretion, and they will take past payments into account as is set out. So I'm quite pleased that that has been recognised, because government does recognise that you know, rent arrears has a significant impact on the small landlord.
Yeah, absolutely. So just for anybody who's not following, what used to happen is that you needed to be 2 months in arrears to have a case go to court. And so some tenants who were in arrears would pay a little bit so that they were no longer 2 months in arrears and the case couldn't go to court. But now with the new discretionary persistent, that won't happen. Or what's drafted, it looks
catered for.
It's catered for. I think that's a great way to look at it. Let's move on now to talk about, and I know that, shout out to Wendy Whittaker-Large, who's been campaigning on this issue. I know with a team of others, and she was saying how helpful the NRLA has been in spearheading this campaign about the council tax on a per room basis that some local authorities have brought in. So tell us what's happening there.
Yeah, I mean, well, simply put, council tax disaggregation. Oh. And it's essentially, Stephanie, where you take a HMO, you're used to paying, you know, council tax for the dwelling, for the whole property. But the local authorities used their powers and effectively banned all of the rooms, band A. And so that has added a huge amount of cost to typically renters, because landlords will pass that on or have bills excluded from the lease. And we say that's not cricket. We worked with Wendy and others on this, because it's not fair. And actually, it's an issue that affects landlords as well as renters, as so many of these issues do. So the point that we're at the moment is that government kind of accepted the argument, and they put out a consultation on how best to kind of deal with this issue. Because, as I say, the law has been there for some time, but some local authorities do it and some don't. And of course, the challenge for us is, you know, how much weight do you put behind it so that you don't, you know, wake other local authorities up to the fact that they could do the same. But yeah, I met with Wendy and Darren Brewer, of Darren ProPod, Brewer, yeah. lovely Darren, And they're passionate about this campaign. Yeah. And, you know, we were very happy to lend our voice and some of our resources and policy team to the issues. So the consultation has closed, as I understand it, and we await the publication of that consultation response that would determine how it goes forward. And it may well be that it could join the renters reform bill in some way as it makes its progression into an act. But we will see. I suspect it's a little bit down the pecking order, to be honest with you, as a standalone issue compared to some of the other things that are going on in the country at the moment. But we wait and see.
Yeah. So just for listeners, if the single banding is where you have the council tax as one, so maybe it's £1,000. And then what they're doing, instead of having a single banding for the whole property, which has got five bedrooms, for example, they're now banding each bedroom individually, which could be £500. So it could go from £1,000 for the property to £2,500 each room individually, or the difference could be more. And those costs, because Darren Brewer was explaining how it's personally affected him and his portfolio, those costs are all to be paid by the tenant. Actually, council tax on a room basis like that is to be paid by the tenant. The councils charge the tenants, not the landlords, although the landlords can contribute, and I think he has done that in some cases. But it's significant, this difference, and hopefully sense will be seen, because they're not individual dwellings.
Exactly right. And I think it's just bluntly a money-making racket, to be honest with you. I mean, the other issue that Darren has rightfully highlighted is, and it is about money, it's not just about the council tax money, actually. It is about the fact that then classifies as a new dwelling.
Yes.
And so you take one house with six, you know,
rooms,
self-contained rooms or whatever, and all of a sudden you've turned one house into six dwellings. Well, and of course, what happens? You get a new homes, or the local authority gets a new homes grant off the back of that for increasing the housing stock. We haven't increased the housing stock. You bloody fudged it. That's what you've done. And so I find it a totally disingenuous way of local authorities making out, not only, you know, charging the earth, but almost being deceptive in terms of their house building or new homes target. It's totally, totally wrong. And I'm afraid it does come back to money. We know that local authorities are strapped for cash, but crikey, you could do something in a fairer way. Because back to my point at the outset, you know, in the context of antisocial behaviour, in the same way that people would look at antisocial behaviour and form a particular view, your average dude on the Clapham omnibus will look at this and say, well, that's not right. And it's not right. Yeah. And I'm so glad that Wendy and Darren brought this particular issue to my attention. And we were able to support them in their valiant campaign. And, let's see where it ends up.
Yeah, well, hopefully it will be sorted out, because it is tantamount to daylight robbery when you hear the detail of what many landlords are going through. And not only the landlords, the tenants, because previous tenants of Darren's, for example, have been contacted years after they've moved out of a room and being charged, you know, one or 2 years of council tax for a room when they took the tenancy on the basis that the council tax was paid by the owner. And now they're being hounded by the council and possibly subject to CCJ's counter court judgments and, you know, affecting their credit record, etc. So it's really quite awful. But
it needs resolving.
It does. So now let's go on to the Supreme Court case. Recently, there was a Supreme Court case which was involving rent to rent, and I came on your new-ish now podcast, Listen Up Landlords. So I'd love it if you could give us a few words about the podcast, how it's been going, and then let's talk about the Supreme Court case.
Yeah, so we started a podcast much like this, really, to talk through the issues of the day informally. And we have a whole range of guests, Stephanie, of which you were one a couple of months or so ago. And we have a whole range of guests from across the sector of the issues that matter to our members, whether that's rental reform, whether it's renting homes in Wales, whether it's HMOs, you know, a whole range of things. We haven't got as many downloads as you, I don't think. 250,000, I think you were celebrating just before we came on. But it's another channel within which to speak and engage with our audience about the work that we're doing. And as you know, I like to champion the role of not just what the NRLA is doing, but also our sector. I'm very proud to be an ambassador of our sector, because I think that, you know, despite issues at the margins, it's a fantastic sector doing fantastic work. And frankly, if we don't shout about it, nobody else is going to.
Absolutely, absolutely. I will put a link to the Listen Up Landlords podcast, the NRLA podcast, which you may not be aware of. I'll link to the episode that I joined you on, Ben, where we talked about that Supreme Court case. So going back to that Supreme Court case, it'd be great to hear your thoughts about
yeah.
it.
So, I mean, we don't routinely intervene on court cases. You know, we much rather prefer to settle issues outside of the court. But on this particular issue, we felt that an intervention was necessary on behalf of responsible landlords to let the court know, not necessarily to support either side, but just to kind of give a factual view of some of the issues in the case. And we're very clear that legitimate rent-to-rent arrangements that are done properly work and have a definite place in our sector. But yeah, I think we all accept that sometimes things go wrong, as did in this particular case. And so it centered on a property that was subject to a rent-to-rent arrangement, and it needed a license. No license was obtained, and the former tenant sought a rent repayment order against the superior landlord, a chap called Rakusen. And they went after him, not the rent-to-rent company. And there was a whole back and forth. So the upper tribunal held that the rent repayment order could be applied for against the superior landlord, but the Court of Appeal found in the superior landlord's favour. And so it went to the Supreme Court, and the central argument that we were interested in is whether licensing the property would be the responsibility of the superior landlord or the rent-to-rent company, which was named on the agreement. So it was very, very specific. And we were at pains, obviously the property hadn't been licensed. It should have been licensed. But we were pleased in the end that it was ruled the rent repayment order couldn't be applied for in the name of the superior landlord, because, you know, I think that would have sent a poor message. I was on BBC News talking about this issue, that actually, yeah, you know, a decent, responsible landlord has put their home, in the charge of a rent-to-rent agent, where the expectation and agreement was that certain things would be done, and they weren't done. Now, there's a whole question mark up there around due diligence and credentials, and we must be very, very careful about who we choose to put our homes homes with, but we didn't think it was right that, you know, given this particular gentleman, he hadn't collected any rent, he had no involvement in the property, he was overseas, he'd clearly set out to do the right sort of thing and was failed. So we were pleased to see the court come down on the side of the landlord in the case.
Yeah, I agree. It was good to see that. It's a protection for landlords and any rent-to-rent business owner. I think there's no excuse. There are some things which might be more fine-graded, but everybody knows that an HMO license is a requirement in most cases, and one needs to look and see what's required in one's area, etc., for the type of property. And if you do want more on that, I did do a podcast episode on that, and I also wrote an article on it, which is at renttorentsuccess.com/Supreme Court, and I'll put a link to that in the show notes. You can have a look and see what was said there and what the implications are for you starting or growing your rent to rent business. Now, we are running short on time, and I had so much more that I wanted to ask you about, Ben, but I think let's just move on to how the NRLA can help rent to rent business owners.
Yeah, so we have a business membership, Stephanie. So as I mentioned, you know, there's a whole range of services that the NRLA provide, right? So a lot of people will see our sort of campaigning and lobbying and media and PR and research work, which is incredibly important against the backdrop of change in our sector. But there's lots of things that we do in addition to that that supports lettings businesses in their day to day. So as part of membership, you've got access to our advice line, open 6 days a week. As I said to you, we had 3,000 calls last week. People are certainly availing of that service. And you can speak to somebody knowledgeable who knows their onions, who can give you the support that you need on a whole range of lettings conundrums. But it's not just that. It's about the documents and forms, the tenancy agreements, the notices, the ancillary products like the information, webinars, regional meetings, yes, conferences. And we do a number of those. And you came to see me in Cardiff, I think, a few weeks or so ago, where we had a great turnout, and we're doing mini conferences off the back of our national conference last year, which will be repeated on the 24th of October. If you're looking for a gig, we hope to have Michael Gove addressing our audience there. And we also do training and accreditation. So this is about, you know, do we want to see lots of regulation and punishing taxes? No, of course we don't. And there's a whole range of work that goes into championing the PRS through research and polls and all of that sort of jazz. But at the end of the day, we also want to be providing the best possible service so that landlords, their agents, other lettings businesses can have a really effective way of operating and manage their tenancies successfully. And so the advice and information all comes as part of that. So there's a link, I think, on the screen now. If anybody is interested in joining, you can join as an individual for £85, or if you are a business member, that's £175 for the year, and you can have up to 5 people on that membership, all accessing the range of services that we provide. So we're a not-for-profit company. Every penny goes back into the running of the business. I'm a landlord, been a landlord for 20 years, love what we do, and we've got really exciting plans. And given that the industry is under attack, Stephanie, you know, there's never been a more important time to join an association that has got your back.
Absolutely. And I always say, if you've been listening for a while, that there's so much opportunity. When anything gets complicated, when people are leaving the area, that's when there's opportunity for people who are willing to do a good job, for people who are willing to put the time in to learn what to do. And you're listening to this sort of podcast, so that's you. And we only will promote things that we actually find useful in our business, in our lives, you know, managing a business, a rent-to-rent business, a property management business, an HMO business. And we have used the NRLA from the start and we absolutely love it. Nikki is more in the weeds of it than me and she often says, oh, I'll give the NRLA a call. I'm not sure about that or whatnot. And it's a great way to get that second chance. And sometimes you don't even have to give a call because everything is also written in plain English on the website. And you can go there and log into your members area and find out the info. So that's, as Ben said, it's nrla.org.uk/join. And we also do have a referral code, which I'll put in the show notes. And that gives you a little bit of money off your joining and it also gives us a little bit of money off our renewal, I think. So if you are joining the NRLA, we'll have the link below for you. And Instagram. NRLA is on Instagram at NRLA_news and Ben Beadle's on Ben Beadle 81. You'll see Ben with lots of famous people going around the country.
Not all of them good, but you know.
promoting the private rented sector and making sure that we get the support that we need to provide the service, the crucial service that we're providing. Ben, as we close today, is there anything you would like to leave people with?
Yeah, I think, look, we're going through a period of uncertainty again, aren't we? You know, we've got higher mortgage rates. We're doing this on the 21st of June. Tomorrow, there is another announcement from the Bank of England, and I'm guessing that is going to be another increase. But, you know, high interest rates, high mortgage rates, high tax rates, lots of regulation. That said, I am still an optimist, Stephanie. And I think, you know, what I hope is that much like COVID, you know, was a blip for the private rented sector and it changed habits over the course of lockdowns and people rethought their living habits and things like that. What I hope is that the association is going to be at the forefront of all of these important discussions, providing really top quality support to our customers and that our customers can take comfort in the sensible and rational arguments that we will make on their behalf so that we don't fall into the mass hysteria of the media around some of these things. So the times are tough, but as my favourite Boyzone song said, when the going gets tough, the tough gets going, right?
Yeah, I love it. I think that's the first time we've had Ben, a Boyzone, quoted on the podcast, so that's a first. And you've got some great phrases, Ben. I can't remember them all now, but some of them did make me chuckle.
Well, we've had Debaucherous and Boyzone on this podcast, haven't we? So,
yeah, so things are looking up. It's just getting better and better. I can see why it's getting so many downloads. Okay, well, thank you so much, Ben, for joining us today. It's been thrilling. And I really like the clarity that you brought with it, the depth of knowledge and the insight. So thank you for joining and look forward to seeing you at the events around the country.
Okay, thanks. Thank you.
And thanks for listening and for watching. Bye for now. Thank you so much for being with me here today. If you would like more, we've written the number one best-selling book on rents to rent. You can find it at rentstorentsuccess.com/book. Reviewers on Amazon have described it as the best rent-to-rent HMO book and also as a definitive reference guide and inspirational. Take your next step today and buy the book. You can find it at rent2rentsuccess.com/book. And I'll see you again next time. Until then, remember, believe bigger. Be bolder, be a game changer.